Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You've brought us a really fascinating stack of sources today, taking us right into the heart of material science, Martensitic transformations. For, over 3,000 years, humans have relied on these changes. Think of forging and quenching steel to make it strong. We know what the finished product looks like, the crystal structures and all that. But the initial moment, that very first step of the change, what metallurgists call nucleation, has just been this profound mystery.
It has. We had these very satisfying explanations for the growth of the crystal, but the trigger itself.
A complete black box.
Exactly. And that's really where classical physics just, well, it failed us. Traditional theory treats the transformation as if it happens uniformly everywhere at once. But all the research is unequivocal. Martensite is heterogeneous.
Meaning it doesn't start everywhere.
It doesn't. It starts at a few very sparsely distributed special sites. And the sheer rarity of those starting points, it just defied all the old models.
So we have this transformation that's critical to modern engineering. We know it starts rarely, but we don't know the how, the actual mechanism.
Right.
Our mission for this deep dive, then, is to use these sources to unpack a general mechanism that models the journey forward from that very first structural shift, from the formation of the embryo.
That's it. We're looking at a sequence of steps derived not from some, theoretical average, but from existing verifiable structural defects within the metal itself.
Okay, let's unpack that. Before we get into the steps, the source describes this whole process as a type of spontaneous plastic deformation. Now, wait a minute. Spontaneous plastic deformation sounds like a contradiction.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, plastic deformation is what happens when you hit something with a hammer, you apply an external force. How can a material internally stress itself enough to cause a permanent change?
It's driven by what the source calls an internal chemical stress. Think of it this way. The parent crystal structure is unstable at lower temperatures. The system wants to shift to the more stable martensite structure.
And that want is the stress.
It's an enormous internal driving force. So the system responds by deforming itself locally and spontaneously. The whole process is really just a sequence of small adjustments that take the particle from a state of maximum coherency
A perfect
to
fit.
minimum coherency with the material around it.
So it sacrifices that perfect fit in these little manageable steps to get to a more stable state. What's that very first essential step?
It has to be faulting on the closest pack planes. And crucially, the displacement to create that fault isn't just generated from thin air. It has to be derived from an existing defect that's already in the lattice.
And to keep things lined up.
To ensure the orientation is maintained, all the later steps have to happen in a way that the initial fault plane remains completely unrotated.
Okay, if the first step is faulting, we have to talk about the energy cost of making a mistake like that. And that brings us right to the energetics, to the stacking fault energy, or gamma.
Precisely. Before we get into the math, just think of gamma conceptually. It's the energetic penalty you pay for messing up that perfect stacking sequence of the crystal. That energy determines if the fault is even feasible.
Okay, and mathematically, what is that penalty made of?
It's the total free energy of that tiny brand new embryo. It's got two main parts. First is the volume energy, which is a combination of the chemical energy you gain by transforming, that's the good part, and the strain energy of trying to fit this new shape into the old one.
Right, the penalty.
And second, there's the surface energy contribution. What's really key to visualize here is that an intrinsic stacking fault, which is just two planes thick, is structurally identical to an HTP embryo. It's the new structure literally peeking out.
So if the sum of all those energies, the reward minus the penalty, is zero or negative.
The material just does it. That's the condition for spontaneous athermal nucleation from a defect. If the stacking fault energy gamma is zero or less, there is effectively no barrier to nucleation at that specific site. The fault becomes stable and it grows.
Okay, let's apply this. The simplest case is face-centered cubic, FCC, transforming into hexagonal close-packed HCP. That's a pretty simple change structurally.
It is. It can be achieved just by passing a certain type of dislocation, a Shockley partial, on every second close-packed plane.
Right. And the thesis looked at Sierny alloys where this happens. What did they find?
They found the Ennis temperature, the temperature where this starts spontaneously, was pretty low, around minus 95 to minus 65 degrees Celsius. And because of that, the chemical driving force, the energy advantage, the metal gains, was tiny, only about minus 30 to minus 34 calories per mole.
That's astonishingly low. It sounds like the material's on a hair trigger. The sources also say the total coherency strain energy for this defect-assisted nucleation was calculated to be just 10 kilomol.
10 calories per mole, and that tiny strain energy figure is the absolute key. Because the barrier is so low, we can use that condition, gamma equals zero, to calculate exactly what size defect is needed to set this whole thing off.
So you find the size of the critical defect by setting gamma to zero and plugging in the numbers. And the answer was?
The calculation showed the required fault size is between 7 and 10 planes thick. And since each partial dislocation creates two atomic planes of the new HCP structure, this critical fault corresponds to an existing arrangement of just 4 or 5 lattice dislocations.
Wow. 4 or 5. That's the moment where abstract theory hits physical reality. We went from a centuries-old mystery to a precise count of 4 or 5 little components.
And it solves that riddle of sparseness we talked about. If it only took one dislocation, martensite would start everywhere, all at once. But the sources confirm that these nucleation sites are extremely rare, maybe 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7 sites per cubic centimeter.
Which is not a lot.
Not at all. And what's fascinating here is that the probability calculation backs this up perfectly. You take a typical dislocation density, about 10 to the 9, and you calculate the odds of finding a group of 4 or 5 dislocations with just the right spacing and character.
And it works out.
It's probable enough to exist, but improbable enough to account for that known sparseness of starting sites. This small, specific arrangement of just 4 or 5 dislocations is the potent but rare trigger we were looking for.
That's incredible validation. But okay, the FCC to HCP transformation is relatively simple. It's just a stacking change. Does this mechanism hold up when things get really complicated, like the transformation from face-centered cubic to body-centered cubic, FCC to BCC?
I mean, you're right. The complexity goes way up, but the underlying principle, it actually stays the same. The lattice change can still be accomplished by a faulting mechanism, specifically one based on the famous Boogers-Berger's double shear model.
The double shear. That's tricky because of that constraint we mentioned, that the fault plane has to remain unrotated. You're changing the whole shape of the crystal without moving the base layer. It's like trying to turn a neat stack of oranges into a cube, but the bottom layer of oranges can't move.
That's a fantastic analogy. And to maintain that consistency, it requires this highly specific choreography for the second shear. The source lays it out. You need a tiny displacement, A, across 7 planes, and then a much bigger B plus C displacement every 8th plane.
And that precise sequence gives you what?
A semi-coherent BCC embryo.
Okay, so let's crunch the numbers for an alloy like F30I, which does this FCC to BCC transformation. Mm-hmm. How do the energetics look there with that much more intense structural change?
Well, in FeV30I, the chemical driving force is much higher, as you'd expect. It's about 300 calories per mole. And when we apply the model to this more complex BCC embryo, the total coherency strain energy is calculated to be 123 calories per mole.
123 strain energy versus 300 in driving force. So the material is spending less than half of its available chemical energy just to get the thing started. That's definitely feasible.
It is. And here is the real punchline for the theory's generality. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the critical defect size calculation for this complex case for FeV30I gives you a fault of about 13.5 planes. And in this more complex BCC case, 3 planes of fault come from 1 lattice dislocation. So that number, again, corresponds almost exactly to an existing defect of 4 to 5 dislocations.
That is striking. The fact that 2 completely different lattice changes, a simple stacking one and a complex volume one, both seem to rely on the same tiny trigger.
4 or 5 dislocations.
It's powerful evidence for the generality of the mechanism. Nature found one efficient trigger and just stuck with it. Now, we focused on how it starts, but what about when? Martensite is famous for being athermal. It depends on temperature, not time. But some alloys are isothermal, right? They're time dependent. Does this model account for that?
It handles it beautifully. The transformation is, at its core, a thermal. It just happens when the energy conditions are right. But it can show time-dependent isothermal kinetics. The theory suggests that in these cases, the material is sitting right on the energetic edge. The thermally activated motion of the partial dislocations that bound the embryo becomes the rate-limiting step.
So the 4 or 5 dislocations are there, but the chemical driving force isn't quite enough to shove them apart on its own. They need a little kinetic energy, a bit of a thermal nudge, to get moving and spread the fault.
That's the exact picture. And because the fault's growth rate is tied directly to the movement of these dislocations, the model predicts that the overall kinetics will show that classic C-curve behavior that we see in these alloys. It fits the experimental data perfectly.
Okay, so we know how and we know when. That leaves where? Where do these specific structural triggers, these hot spots, actually exist in a real crystal?
This is where direct experimental observation really clinches it. The sources show that the most complex interfaces, the places where four or five dislocations of the right type are most likely to bunch up, are, in fact, the nucleation sites.
Okay, like...
First, they observed grain boundary segments. In Asado alloys, they literally watched embryo faults growing right out of small segments of grain and subgrain boundaries.
That makes intuitive sense. Grain boundaries are just reservoirs of misfit and dislocations.
They are, but it's the segments, the corners, where different arrays meet that have the precise geometry needed. Second, they found incoherent twin boundaries. In one Feni alloy, an embryo fault was seen starting right at the corner formed by an incoherent segment joining a coherent one.
The intersection of order and chaos.
A perfect place to find that localized array. Third, there are inclusion particle interfaces. Faults were seen coming right off of inclusion particles in a foil. Any foreign object creates a strain field that can attract and bundle those dislocations.
And finally.
Finally, the most common sites for the complex FCC to BCC transformation are strain-induced sites. These are usually the intersections of various shear bands, often where simpler existing martensite plates cross each other. Those intersections physically force the dislocations into the required bundle.
So that pulls it all together.
Yeah.
All these observed sites, grain boundaries, twin corners, inclusions, shear bands, they're all places capable of providing that specific array of just four or five dislocations. We've gone from a vague idea of defect sites to a quantifiable structural requirement.
Mm.
So let's sum up this deep dive. We started with this great mystery of martensite nucleation, and we've emerged with a consistent general mechanism based on sequential faulting on the closest packed planes.
And we've established that this process is basically a spontaneous plastic deformation driven by internal chemical stress. And critically, it's kicked off by this incredibly specific yet small pre-existing defect, a group of just four or five dislocations. It's a framework that works for simple and complex transformations, and it predicts the kinetics. This does raise an important question for future research, though. The sources are careful to note that while the theory is strong, the initial faults observed in the Feni alloys are believed to be BCC embryos, but the direct, definitive proof of their crystal structure is still needed.
So we can see the fault, but we can't be 100% sure of its exact atomic arrangement yet.
Not yet. More transmission electron microscopy experiments are needed to test their diffraction contrast and confirm the exact structure and orientation of those initial faults. It just shows how incredibly difficult it is to catch a transformation in its absolute first atomic steps.
That's fascinating. We're talking about a mechanism that dictates the strength and properties of alloys used in everything from airplanes to surgical implants, and its starting point is dictated by the precise microscopic arrangement of just four or five specific atoms. That's something to consider. How the smallest structural flaw ultimately controls a material's destiny.